Thanks for being with us, everyone. I'm George Knapp in for George Norrie tonight. Our thanks to Chuck Zukowski, who came on in the first hour there to talk about cattle mutilations in Colorado. I don't know how many of you recognize this name, Ben Rich, the late Ben Rich, who was sort of the genius who guided the Lockheed Company into creating some of the greatest, unquestionably the greatest flying machines that we've ever heard of. Ben Rich, before he died, had told some friends and confidants in the aviation industry that we are 50 years ahead of anything that the public can even imagine. Things that would make George Lucas drool. I think he's allegedly said something to the effect that we have the technology to go to the stars and back, but it's so bottled up in black projects and classification systems that we may never know about these things. Well, one guy who is likely to know about it, he's been writing about it for most of his life, spent 22 years with Aviation Week and space technology, earned all kinds of awards and the respect of everyone who's ever worked with him. His name is William Scott, Bill Scott. I've crossed paths with him myself in the past, and he's written a new book called Counterspace based on his knowledge of advanced military systems and technologies derived from all of the many contacts he's established over the years within companies that work for our military. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Bill Scott about what's really flying around up there and what the future might hold as he discusses his new book, Counterspace, The Next Hours of World War III. I'm George Knapp, and we'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. Aviation writer Bill Scott not only talked the talk, he walked the walk. I mean, he wrote for 22 years for Aviation Week and Space Technology, has authored a couple of books, but he also put in the time. He spent 12 years of military and civilian flight testing. He evaluated aircraft for the magazine, of course, logged all kinds of hours, thousands of hours of flight time on 80 different aircraft. He spent 9 years with the Air Force. He also worked with the NSA for a time. And he knows what he's talking about. Bill, I'm so glad to have you on the show.
Hey, George, good to be here.
And you and I did cross paths a long time ago, and we'll talk about that an hour or so down the road, because that's kind of fun stuff. I'm looking at your new book here. I've started it. I haven't finished it. It's called Counterspace, The Next Hours of World War III, co-authors Michael Koumatos and Bill Burns. And I'll tell you, it's really similar to Tom Clancy. I mean, you're talking about real technology, realistic situations. Some things, I guess, that are based on actual events and really believable characters. So I'm really enjoying what I'm seeing so far.
Oh, good. Glad you are. Counterspace, of course, is a sequel. The first book was Space Wars, the first 6 hours of World War III. And Counterspace just picks up where Space Wars left off.
You know, before we get into the technology, and that's what we want to talk about a lot, these actual flying machines and other things up there, let's talk scenarios, because you know, that's ways in which World War III might erupt. We concentrate so much on these crazy terrorists who want to blow up their underwear and take down a plane, but not always on terrorist states, which that's sort of the focus of what you look at. You know, I think about this goofball tyrant who runs North Korea. He's like this bad Elvis impersonator, but, you know, he happens to be packing some nukes in his rhinestone jumpsuit. Your book sort of starts with a scenario involving North Korea. Tell us about it.
You bet. Counterspace kicks off with North Korea launching a missile, and of course that gets the attention of all of our satellites that watch for those things, and alerts NORAD here in Colorado Springs, and everybody's watching the missile. It's going straight up. They're waiting for it to arc over, because as soon as it starts its arc over trajectory, then you can figure out where it's going. But it doesn't. It goes to 137 miles straight up, and then boom. A nuclear weapon goes off. Surprises everybody, but of course what it does is kill more satellites out there in space with the prompt radiation. And it's at just the right altitude to create an electromagnetic pulse that, you know, hits the ground, and that causes all kinds of damage on the Earth. It knocks out chips. It takes out all kinds of circuitry. So our bad-haired boy has hurt not only our space infrastructure, but a lot of things on the ground, too.
And could one device do that all over the world?
It wouldn't be all over the world, George. It would pretty much, you know, just take out electronics in the northern Pacific. And but it would project out quite a ways. Back in the 60s, The Russians torched off a large megaton level weapon up in right at the fringe of space, because you have to have some atmosphere before it'll really create an EMP, electromagnetic pulse, and it wiped out a lot of things in the Pacific. We did the same thing later on, another test, and as I recall, it whacked a lot of electronics for almost 800 miles around the center of the weapon.
And was that the purpose of both the Russian and the American tests you're describing?
I think it was to see what kind of effects you would have when you torched off a weapon in space. But I think the EMP aspect, electromagnetic pulse, was a surprise to a lot of people.
And so describe what it would do to our capabilities then, to America's capabilities. I guess that takes out our eyes, or not all of them, but most of them?
If it knocks out more of the satellites, and it would only hit the satellites that are in direct view of where the detonation happened, because, you know, the radiation is going to travel in a straight line, basically, but it goes a long ways out there. So in the book, Counter Space, it knocks out a few more of our spy satellites, both the imaging birds that basically take pictures of things on the Earth, as well as the signal intelligence birds. These are the ones listening to the terrorist cell phone conversations, that sort of thing. Also knocks out a few more of our GPS satellites. So immediately you lose the navigation positioning capabilities we get from GPS. Of course, some of them are still working, but not all of them now. And, of course, we get this very important timing signal from GPS. So some of the other strange effects are that without that timing signal, it can disrupt a lot of financial transactions on the Earth. And if it whacks a few more, you know, commercial satellites and such, it immediately affects our daily lives down here. For instance, if you go to the gas station, put your card in, pay at the pump, the authorization often goes by satellite. So you're standing there waiting for the authorization. It says, cannot authorize, George Knapp cannot pump gas today. Go inside and see the attendant. And if you trot down the road, try to get some money out of the ATM, you may find the same thing. Why? Because the authorization process often goes through certain commercial satellites. So immediately, we have a real problem on the national security side, as well as our economic security side. And it comes right down to the individual. Losing satellites affects the individual very quickly. We like to say it's if we were to lose some of our satellites, it's like pouring molasses on society. Everything slows down.
Talk about some scenarios in which, the war game scenarios, I guess, in which the North Koreans would do something like this. What could prompt them to do it? And obviously they wouldn't do it just operating by themselves with that one act, right?
That's right. In our book, the premise is that because we have two carrier, naval aircraft carrier groups, out there in the northern Pacific, and they're actually steaming north because some of the geopolitical problems triggered by losing satellites translate to a lot of people, like China, doesn't know what we're doing. We can't see everything that China, Iran, North Korea are doing. Well, the North Koreans get a little excited because these carriers are moving sort of in their direction. So with a little help from some bad guys in Iran, they scare the North Koreans and Kim Jong-il to the point where he says, I'm going to torch this nuke off to create the EMP that will, in his mind, it would damage these carriers and the electronics in the airplanes on the carriers, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of why he did this in the first place. But, of course, in the process, he whacks a few more satellites, and in our fictional scenario, of course, the carriers ride it out pretty well. They don't have too much damage because most of the military hardware is radiation and EMP hardened.
So the North Koreans pulled this off. They're working in conjunction with other people. They might provide, for example, cover for other kinds of mischief, for terrorist groups, for other rogue states.
That's right. In our scenario there, Iran is sort of the central bad guy, if you will. And what they were wanting to do was poke out more of the United States' eyes in space. So So Iran says, aha, now that the United States has lost more satellites. Of course, in the first book, Space Wars, we already lost a number of satellites to some other bad guy operations. But Iran was quick to take advantage of that, and that's one of the messages we wanted to get across in both these books, that if we start losing our space assets, that gives some of the bad actors of the world an opportunity to create mischief, and they're quick to capitalize on it. In this case, in counterspace, Iran, by actually using North Korea as a proxy to kill more of our space capabilities, that gives Iran the opportunity to unleash what we call Allah's sword. So it's an Iranian operation, multi-pronged. So one thing they do is they launch a nuclear-tipped missile at Israel. So they are fully intending to take Israel off the map, as Ahmadinejad has threatened to do. But at the same time, they unleash some terrorist cells within the U.S. Why? Because Iran feels like the United States, having lost a lot of its space capabilities, are worried about other things. So we're not watching Israel, we're not watching our own homeland security quite as much. And they capitalize on the loss of our GPS capabilities, or at least they're degraded. So one quick scenario is that these terrorist cells, they spoof, we call it S-P-O-O-F, the GPS signals, and they can coax an airliner off course as it's descending through clouds to land there in Ontario, California, and it smacks a mountain, so we lose a whole airline full of people. And they do this very same thing, spoofing GPS, to lure a Chinese container ship that's steaming into Long Beach Harbor. They can lure it off course. Again, bad weather, night, and they were just relying on GPS. So they run into some, Long Beach Harbor. We put a liquid natural gas terminal there. It's not really there, but in fiction, you can build one in a hurry. and it torches off, creates a lot of damage there. So that's just real quick how some of the rogue actors of the world can capitalize on the losses of space capabilities and immediately bring the fight right into our own doorstep.
Bill, take a minute or two and tell us about the research project process to create a book like this. I mean, you've got a lot of contacts in military circles, aviation circles. Do you sit down and run this by them, or you're just basically making it up off the top of your head? I guess what I'm asking is, how realistic are these things? How possible is it that some of these things could happen?
I'm glad you asked that, George, because it gives me a chance to tell you why we wrote these books and really what were the reasons for some of the themes that we included in there. Back when I was still a reporter for Aviation Week here in Colorado Springs, I was covering the whole military space community. U.S. Space Command at the time was here, headquarters, Air Force Space Command, Army Space and Missile Defense Center, Command. So there are all kinds of military space activities headquartered right here in Colorado Springs at Peterson Air Force Base. And, of course, NORAD is here. So I, over a period of about 8 years, got to know and interviewed any number of the senior leaders out here. So I went through four of the four-star commanders here. And I realized after a while that I was hearing the same story over that eight-year period. That story is, we are highly dependent on our satellites. If we lose them, they're very vulnerable. And if we do start losing them, we're in real trouble. So I kept writing that story, and then I realized, hey, I've written this story like four times. And the aerospace community, they got it. I mean, we all agreed from industry through the military, yes, we have a serious problem, we need to address it. But Washington really wasn't paying attention. Why? Because space is transparent. You know, it's just there. The capabilities we get from it are kind of like the light switch. You throw the light switch on, 99% of the time the electricity comes on, right? Space is the same way. So that was pretty frustrating to a lot of folks out here. The four stars kept going back and testifying. Bottom line was Congress, administration had bigger things to worry about. So I was having lunch with Mike Kamatos, my co-author, who is a real wargaming expert, and he was conducting a number of military war games with the same space community. And I said, hey, this is what I'm finding out. And he said, you know, we're finding the same thing in the wargaming community. We keep coming up with the same answers. To the point where after one of those war games, a senior officer said, you know, maybe we ought to just forget about doing these war games because we keep running into the same things. And this astute colonel who was doing the briefing said, sir, it's because we have not solved the problems. We have not addressed these problems yet. So they continue to be problems. So Mike and I said, what if we wrote a fiction book to tell people what might happen if we start losing our space capabilities? And why fiction? Well, because fiction allows you to put things into perspective. So you can kind of see how you get from A to Z and what the effects are on the average human being, the average American citizen. So that's what we did. That's how Space Wars came about. And not only because of our book, but perhaps aided by it, Washington started getting it. The feedback from some of the senior military leaders these days is Washington now gets it. And it remains to be seen whether that'll translate to the proper actions, resources, et cetera.
But it's, yeah, I was going to say, getting it and acting on it are two different things.
That's right, exactly. There's a lot of priorities in Washington now. Many people have certain agendas, and there's just not a lot of money to go around. But it's more than resources. One of the big things that we tried to point out in both of our books was the dearth of policy, doctrine, that sort of thing. So if we do have a dust-up that involves people attacking our satellites and such, we really don't have the infrastructure in place, the policies and doctrines, et cetera, to say, is that an act of war? And if it is, what do we do about it? And because of that, it really leaves our senior military commanders in a tough spot. You know, they're having to make things up on the fly. And, of course, if it really got into a true war, our political leaders would be in the same boat. So that's why we actually, and there are a lot of other things, too. First of all, you know, is it an attack on a satellite or is it a natural phenomenon? Have we lost a satellite due to a solar flare or did somebody intentionally knock it out? So that, and then translating into, okay, who's doing it?
Well, how can you tell? How could you tell if it was just a solar flare versus an attack?
Not easy, George. We get signals coming down from the satellites. The engineers pore over the data, and you know it takes time to figure out what caused it to die. And of course, if you start losing other satellites, then you look for are they all going down because of the same thing? So that's why we said, as a subtitle of the first book, Space Wars, the first 6 hours of World War III. People say, well, the book goes on for a lot more than 6 hours. Yes, but it could be hours, days, before we even realize that we're at war in space, because it may take that long to determine what was the cause. That's getting better. That's getting better. We're starting to get some systems that are put on at least the national security, the military satellites, intelligence satellites, to tell us pretty quickly whether somebody is messing with it, trying to jam us or hitting us with a laser or something else. But a lot of the commercial satellites, you know, they don't have that. The commercial guys that provide an awful lot of services for us, communications, direct TV, you know, even cable TV, a lot of the signals come by satellite before they come back and are broadcast, you know, over the cable channel there in Las Vegas, for instance. You know, if you lose a satellite, a lot of things go down. And the commercial guys may have a tough time figuring out exactly what causes it.
Hey, we'll come back to that. Bill Scott is my guest. He's the co-author of the new book, Counterspace, The Next Hours of World War III. I want to ask him if these scenarios in the book are actually played out from war games, and also makes you wonder whether the North Koreans and the Iranians have played out the same war games. We'll get into that more when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Bill Scott, the co-author of Counterspace, a not-so-fictional narrative about what would happen if the North Koreans, in conjunction with the Iranians, decide to explode nukes in Earth orbit, and it would be bad. So, you know, it's based on war game scenario, as we've learned, and it is a novel, but you have to wonder if these guys, Bill Scott and his co-authors, can think about it and imagine it. You wonder if the Iranians and the North Koreans have thought about it as well. When we come back, we'll ask Bill Scott if he has any intel on that. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Bill Scott, co-author of the new book, Counterspace, The Next Hours of World War III. Bill, you probably heard the tease there where I want to get into specifics about North Korea and Iran. You know, I know you have to do a lot of research about the potential bad guys to have a credible narrative in your book. Did you? And did you have access to information from unnamed friends who maybe know more about the situations in those countries than the rest of us?
I wouldn't say a lot of unknown friends or sources there, but it's pretty straightforward. Been in media, I wrote about it, etc. The fact that asymmetric warfare is reality now, and what that really means is that countries like Iran, North Korea, and especially China, they aren't too anxious to take on the United States and its allies in a conventional war or, you know, God forbid, even a nuclear war. But they're very astute in knowing that we have Achilles' heels, and two of those are our space infrastructure and cyberspace. In other words, if they can attack us with viruses and worms and such and get into our electronic systems via the internet or disrupt our space capabilities, they can very quickly injure us, cripple us, and affect our military abilities. General Lance Lord, former Air Force Space Command, four-star out here, he was very straightforward. He said, if we lose our space capabilities, we cannot fight the way we plan to fight now as a military. So Iran, North Korea, China, others are very aware of that, and even Chinese military officials have gone on the record in print saying that they actually have plans to take out some of our space capabilities and attack us through the cyber realm as well.
Well, talk to me for a minute, for example, about North Korea. You know, we all see it in the news here and there when they fire off a missile test or yank our chain about whether they have nukes or not. How dangerous are they? How unstable? How crazy?
I would say they're definitely a real threat because they're not very predictable. As you know, during the Cold War, things settled into a certain realm, if you will, of predictability. We had a pretty good idea of what the Soviet capabilities were, and they had a pretty good idea of what ours were. North Korea is such a wild card, we just don't really know. Yes, we have intelligence, overhead intelligence that keeps an eye on them, but, you know, they're pretty good at hiding things underground, almost impossible to get agents in there. It's such a closed society, and yet their leadership is so unpredictable that, they're definitely a threat. And they have such a large conventional army that if they decided to pour across the border, you know, they would be in Seoul, Korea, South Korea there, pretty doggone quick. So, yes, I would say North Korea is a real threat, and I think most of our leaders feel the same way.
Have they, in fact, carried out this same war game scenario, do you think, or do you know?
I don't know whether they have or not. I'm sure that their military officials do war game, and they do look at, you know, at what we call the seams and fault lines in the Allied side, too. Look at the United States. You know, where are their weaknesses? Well, that's what we just talked about, space, cyberspace. So, of course, they're going to work on those things.
Well, I asked the question because
they have war game them, I'm sure.
I wanted to ask the question because I didn't want you to get hammered for giving them an idea they didn't already have.
Good point. No, I figure in anything we have in these books, the bad guys, the rogue states, have already thought of and figured out. So one of the advantages of putting these stories in fiction, I would say, is more to alert our own people to the potential dangers there and you know, further the dialogue, get it up into the public realm, and let's talk about these things and raise some of these issues to the point where we can actually get things done, like, you know, get some policies in place, pin down some doctrine. I mean, we've had, you know, the law of the sea for, you know, quite some time, and the whole world operates to a set of standards. So everybody's allowed to use the oceans, the seas, for shipping, for commerce, etc. And the rules of the road, if you will, are pretty well laid out there. Not so in space. So there again, if somebody starts messing with a satellite, whether it's ours or somebody else's, it's not clear whether that's considered an act of war or what the response should be or anything. I'll give you a quick scenario there that how that uncertainty affects the guys who would have to answer the phone. One of these four stars, who is now retired, used to run Space Command. He told me in an interview that he said, "Bill, one of my greatest nightmares is getting that call from the White House in the middle of the night that says, what's happening to our spacecraft, who's behind it, and what are we doing about it?" He said, "I do not want my answers to be, I don't know, I don't know, and I don't know."
Tell me this now about the other bad actor in this scenario, the situation you describe in the book, Iran. Give me your capsule version of what's going on there and how big of a threat that country is.
I think there's no question that they really do have a nuclear weapons program underway, and they are very good at slow rolling the world community. So again, in our books, we try to highlight that fact, the fact that they're pretty sneaky, and they will use any number of means to delay, you know, to say, okay, we're ready to talk about this program. And then about the time things start to get rolling, they say, no, we don't want to talk about it anymore. And, oh, by the way, we do have this underground nuclear facility, but it's just for peaceful purposes. Trust us. You know, and meanwhile, they keep putting in more and more centrifuges so that they can refine more and more uranium. And yes, we have an international community that tries to keep track of these things. And, you know, some of them are convinced that it is all for peaceful purposes. But I think more and more the international community is saying, no, these guys are out to build a nuclear weapon. They probably have the capabilities to make one in the very near future. And then you have to ask, what are they going to do with it? Well, they've said, you know, pretty doggone clear that they're going to wipe Israel off the map to start with. So, again, in our book, we go through some of these scenarios because counterspace takes place in 2011. We can kind of look out a couple of years. Now it's almost just 1 year ahead, right?
Right.
And say, what would happen if they did throw one over there at Tel Aviv? Well, Israel hopefully has a good enough missile defense system in place to counter it, but then they will strike back. And they do in our book. They strike back in pretty severe fashion, and they're using technologies and systems that are out there right now. That's one thing we really want to do is make sure we use systems and weapons that are in being right now, or that we think are in being, and not get into science fiction. So everything in there, in both of these books, are based on real technologies, real systems, and I will jump out there because you mentioned it earlier, George, and mentioned that we use a space plane system, a two-stage to orbit space plane that we call Black Star. And I can't, you know, open the door and show you one of those now, but as an AV week guy, I chased that system for like 16 years. And back when you and I talked, that's probably what we were looking for. At the time, we didn't know what it was. We thought it was called Aurora or something like that. But anyway, even without hardcore evidence, and I don't have a tire from the Black Star space plane here in my office, but pretty certain that it does exist, and we show how something like that can be extremely valuable to run up there to orbit and do some things like putting small satellites, we call them nanosatellites, up there to do certain jobs. And we can drive over and take a look at China's satellites. And then, of course, the rods from God scenario that we use in space wars. You can actually fire hypervelocity missiles from orbit and take out one of those Iranian underground nuclear facilities.
I want to get into some detail on all those technologies. Before we leave the political scenario, though, the Iranians, you see what's happening over the last week or so in that country. Looks like the mullahs are maybe losing their grip a little bit, or they're on the verge of something really big, a revolution maybe. I don't know. At the same time, that instability is being fomented. We had this report in the news that I mentioned earlier on this program of the Iranians supposedly trying to acquire 1,350 tons of yellow cake from Kazakhstan. That's a whole bunch of volatile, different pieces of a puzzle that really present a challenging scenario.
Boy, that's for sure. And I think it's an extremely dangerous time, because if Ahmadinejad and the mullahs feel like they're losing their grip on Iran, two things are likely to happen. One, of course, what we're seeing now, crackdowns on the protesters and the moderates. But the other thing is, that's probably a good time to stir up trouble on the international scene. So as Iran becomes more unstable, the leadership there may do something. You know, attacking Israel is just one possibility, but they may do any number of things just to take the focus off their own internal problems. And hopefully, if they perceive a threat from the outside that they could probably trigger, then that could tend to unite the Iranian people and, again, keep these folks in power.
What about China? We like to believe that China is our friend. They're certainly a customer. We have a lot of business interests. It's hard to get a handle on where the Chinese are vis-a-vis the United States, whether we got to worry about them as being bad guys or what. But they play a role. That country plays a role in your scenarios as well.
That's exactly right. In fact, China is kind of the culmination of our book. Tensions continue to rise throughout the book, even as things are going on with North Korea, Iran, Venezuela. I'll mention it a little bit later, the terrorists. But all the time, tensions in China escalate. And in some ways, the United States aggravates that. And it comes right down to the start of a shooting war at the end, and we just narrowly avoid nuclear war, or I should say we come right to the brink of nuclear war with China. And we try to address some of those very issues you mentioned, George. What is China? Well, I think China has many faces. You know, some of their political face, their commercial face, versus the People's Liberation Army face. And we're never quite certain which one we're dealing with at a time. Again, we try to bring out some of those elements, at least in a limited sense in the book, and point out this engagement versus containment issue. And I think that's what you alluded to. You know, do we embrace China as a partner, equal on the world scene, as a critical trading partner, of course, or are they considered a threat and they need to be contained through political and other means out there in the Pacific? That's always been a problem. It's been wrestled with in war games here, in policy discussions, etc. But in our book, we take kind of a very controversial approach there, and we pretty much ask the question, if we poke out the satellite eyes, if you will, of China, and they can no longer track what we're doing, and we've already lost some of our ability to monitor what they're doing, then everybody in the mix there, U.S. and China primarily, has to go to this most conservative, most protective mode, what I call a defensive crouch, right? So we resolve all this with what we call the shoes of the fisherman scenario, and I won't spoil the book for everybody there, but if you go back to that old Anthony Quinn movie.
Sure, yeah, I remember.
Where he, playing the Pope, pledged the wealth of the Catholic Church to feed the Chinese people, and as a result, avoid war. Well, there's an analogy to that in our book, but it's going to be controversial. A lot of people will say, hey, we don't want to do that with China because, but again, we thought it might be an interesting way to raise the issue for discussion.
Well, I'll tell you, you sure get the feeling that China plays both sides of the fences, that
You're right.
they have a foot in all kinds of camps.
Yep, they definitely do. And a great example of that is in early 07 when China shot down one of its own satellites. And the political side there seemed to be almost surprised by the world's reaction. It said, how could you do such a thing? You just created 2,000 more pieces of debris up there for everybody to have to worry about. And they seemed to be surprised at the backlash they got. But there were certain elements that said maybe the political side didn't even make that decision, because People's Liberation Army and their rocket forces and their air force, in some ways, they kind of run open loop. They sort of do their own thing, or at least we think they do. So how much of this is just secret goings on behind the scenes, where maybe they are coordinating this sort of thing, and yet on the public scene, you have the political guys acting one way, the military guys acting another way, and of course, in the middle of all this are the commercial guys that say, we just want to make money.
Well, that's maybe the scariest scenario of all, if there's more than one power center and more than one group calling shots over there.
It sure is. And we try to touch on that a little bit in the book, but as you know, that's a massive issue.
Hey, help me understand this, Bill. How much of our military stuff is hardened? How much of it's protected already? And what might it cost to get everything up to par? Because I'm sure people are saying, this guy's just coming on to shop this idea in order to get a bunch of money for his pals in the Department of Defense.
That's a great question. And most of the military combat hardware, communication systems, et cetera, they are hardened, because for decades now, you know, we always had to worry about that potential nuclear exchange. However, as we came out of the Cold War, there's been more and more of a push towards, let's just get something out there that's cheap enough, gets by, and works, right? Well, let's just put commercial electronics in some of these systems. They work fine. They're more advanced, typically, than a lot of the military stuff. They can get it out there quicker. We can change it faster. And, you know, we change cell phones how often? Pretty doggone quick. Well, the equivalent on the military side would take years to get out there. So there's a lot of good reasons to use a lot of the commercial grade gear. However, most of that stuff is not hardened, and in any sort of a exposure to EMP or nuclear radiation, it's going to go down. No, I don't think there's any need for a massive dump of money into the system to harden everything, because most of the critical infrastructure is hardened. I think what is more important, though, is that we have the means to protect our satellites in particular, because if anything does happen, we need to have measures that are in many ways automatic, and they don't have to be super expensive things. It's just a matter of doing them and taking the hit. And then you would like to have the commercial community do the same thing. Why? Because a lot of our national security requires or uses a lot of the commercial systems. And I think during the last Gulf War, it was a very high percentage. I don't know the exact number, but on the order of 70 to 80% of the communications used by military forces that went into Iraq, communicating back to the U.S. for logistics and any number of things, 80% of it roughly went by commercial systems.
Okay, so even if every single military intelligence satellite survives something like this, we could be crippled and hurt real bad if they take out the commercial ones.
That's exactly right. So the military guys, you know, they've been talking for 10 years plus, and I've reported on that too back in the 90s, that, you know, talking to the commercial guys. And I can give you more of that later.
All right. Well, we're taking a break. In the next hour, I want to get back into the technology that Bill has hinted about, the space plane, Black Star, nano satellites, rods from the gods, hypervelocity missiles, all kinds of exotic stuff. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM.